It looks like it's virtually the entirety of the Chukchi and Beaufort Sea.
Off limits. With a month left in office, President Obama removes much of Alaska's Arctic waters from future oil and gas exploration. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, December 20th. Good evening. I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a push to end violence against sex workers.
He said he could kill as many of us as he wanted because nobody cares.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT now or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
President Obama today put nearly all waters in the U.S. Arctic off limits for future oil and gas drilling. The White House announced the decision in conjunction with a similar announcement from the Canadian government covering its Arctic waters. Obama used a rarely deployed power in the Offshore Leasing Act to remove areas from leasing consideration for an indefinite period of time. As APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, the law includes no way for the next president to reverse his decision.
Since Shell halted its exploratory drilling in the Chukchi Sea last year, no company has seemed close to returning to federal waters in the Arctic. But Alaska officials and industry trade associations have been desperately trying to keep the door open to future activity in the area. Joshua Kindred of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association looked with dismay at the map of the president's new withdrawals.
It looks like it's virtually the entirety of the Chukchi and Beaufort Sea that would be exempt. So, yeah, that's about as an absolute as of a withdrawal as could be.
The White House cited the area's important ecology, subsistence, and the health of marine mammals in explaining the decision. The action drew immediate praise from environmental groups. By acting jointly with our North American neighbor, supporters say the U.S. isn't merely pushing the development into Canadian Arctic waters. But Kindred says the announcement does nothing to lessen the risks of Russian drilling.
And by us not having our own energy companies in the region, we are less prepared to respond if there was an incident in the Russian Chukchi Sea, just miles away from U.S. Arctic waters. So it is a very sort of reactionary way to approach this.
Obama made the withdrawals, just as environmental groups requested, using a provision of the Offshore Leasing Act known as 12A. It does not affect the rights of existing leaseholders. Obama also left 2.8 million acres of the nearshore Beaufort, close to the existing oil fields and pipelines, outside of his withdrawal. Though created with the stroke of a presidential pen, the Obama withdrawals could be tough to get rid of.
12A says the president has the power to withdraw these lands. It does not give a president the power to unwithdraw lands previously withdrawn.
Law professor John Leshy was the top attorney in the Interior Department under President Clinton. He says it's doubtful President Trump could issue an order undoing the Arctic withdrawal.
It's never been done, so we don't have any judicial test of this, but there is related law that basically says that when Congress gives the president authority to do something and does not give the president the authority to undo it, the president doesn't have the authority to undo it. So it is permanent.
On the other hand, the law professor says it's clear Congress can pass a bill to cancel a 12A withdrawal. Alaska Congressman Don Young says he doesn't buy the argument that the incoming president can't cancel Obama's decision.
If I was the president, I'd just go ahead and tell his Secretary of Interior Mineral Management to put it up for lease. Now let them take it to court.
Young issued a press release calling Obama's action a cowardly move by a lame duck president.
I say he'll go down as one of the worst presidents we've ever had.
Young says he thinks the House will move a bill next year to undo this order and lots of other Obama decisions. He says it would easily pass the House, but Young declined to speculate on its fate in the Senate. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
December 17th was the International Day to End Violence Against Sex Workers. A group of advocates in Anchorage say one way to do that is to make information sharing safer. Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman has more.
The day marks the anniversary of the capture of the Green River Killer, a serial murderer who targeted sex workers in Washington state.
He confessed to killing dozens of sex workers, and he said he could kill as many of us as he wanted because nobody cares.
That's Tara Burns, an advocate with Community United for Safety and Protection. It's an organization that lobbies to change laws about the sex industry in Alaska. An Alaska serial killer, Robert Hansen, also targeted sex workers and was convicted of killing 17 women in 1984. Burns says there have been 11 unsolved cases of murdered or missing sex workers in Alaska since the mid-1990s. Sex worker and advocate Maxine Dugan says they are easy targets for crime and discrimination because their profession is criminalized. They don't feel like they can report things like rape or assault to police because then they could be at risk for prosecution themselves. She says that means information about unsolved cases may not be getting back to law enforcement, and police may not hear about crimes that are happening now, which could lead to more violence in the future.
Oftentimes, those types of perpetrators are going to start out with rape, with robbery, and that's why it's important to have people in the sex trade have a path to come forward and make those reports before that perpetrator goes on and commits those more horrendous crimes.
Part of that path was built in SB 91, the criminal justice reform bill that was signed in July. One portion of the new law says people can't be prosecuted for prostitution if they report being victims or witnesses of violent crimes that include sex trafficking, assault, and robbery. Anchorage Municipal Prosecutor Seneca Thino says it's unclear how that provision of the state statute applies to the state's largest city. In some cases, municipal codes can supersede state laws.
I can't tell you whether right now, today, it applies to us or not. I've heard some legal arguments as to how it would. I've heard some legal arguments as to how it wouldn't. So we've researched the issue. We continue to research the issue.
Thino says ultimately it would have to be decided in court. But she doesn't think it will come to that because the city is not focused on charging people with prostitution. The number of prostitution cases in Anchorage has dropped from 152 in 2009 to just 2 this year. Thino says that's primarily because of a philosophical shift. They're looking for potential traffickers instead.
You know, we're telling APD, focus on the trafficking. Don't spend your resources doing prostitution stings down on Spinard.
Advocates Burns and Dugan say the best way to improve safety for sex workers is to decriminalize the sex industry altogether. It's a view which is shared by Amnesty International and the British medical journal Lancet. Studies in Lancet show that the criminalization of the industry increases workers' risk of HIV infection, violence, and abuse. Other international organizations disagree, saying decriminalizing it in places like Germany has led to more sex trafficking and increased victimization of women of color. In Anchorage, I'm Ann Hillman.
Preparations for the 2017 World Ice Art Championships are continuing in Fairbanks despite a fire that destroyed the annual ice sculpture event's main building on Friday.
Saturday, we harvested 120 blocks of ice. You know, we're going to have the event. The event's going on as normal because ice does not burn.
Ice Alaska Board Chairman Hank Bartos says the board is meeting this week to talk about what it's going to take besides ice to pull off the event, which is scheduled to start in about 2 months. Bartos says the building, which burned, was also the residence of Ice Alaska officials Dick and Hoa Brickley and was insured at the minimum of $1.5 million. Brickley says one option being considered for replacing the burned building is converting another large structure at the Ice Alaska venue that's currently used for cold storage. Brickley says he believes the renovation can happen in time for this year's ice carving event. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, one Native village has gotten millions in federal money to move due to climate change, but it isn't in Alaska.
Why is it that this place in Louisiana got money, but these other towns in Alaska did not?
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. It's a fact. 85% of Alaska Native and American Indian people don't use illegal drugs. For more resources on building a healthy life, visit anthc.org/we are. This message sponsored by ANTHC, a nonprofit organization.
Alaska Airlines is now the fifth largest airline in the nation after acquiring Virgin America Airlines last week. In a release, CEO of Alaska Air Group, Brad Tilden, says the two airlines may appear to be different, but they share a similar focus on quality of customer service and care for employees. The merger agreement between the two airlines was signed in April and approved in July by Virgin America shareholders. Both Alaska Airlines and Virgin America plan to spend the next year securing Federal Aviation Administration certification to operate both airlines as a single carrier. The Alaska Pacific University Board of Trustees voted yesterday to partner with the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium to transform the small Anchorage-based university into a tribal college. KMBA's Jacqueline Estes reports.
The Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium is part of a statewide network of tribal health organizations with experience in growing their own people to serve on the front lines of providing health services in rural Alaska. They train mid-level dental health aides, community health aides, and water and sewer plant operators, among others. Alaska Pacific University trustee John Wanamaker says that experience is valuable anywhere there are sparsely populated rural areas.
It's more than just local, and the opportunity is such that I see the ability to attract students and people from all over the globe to the university, basically leveraging off the expertise and excellence that ANTHC is, and credibility, reputation that ANTHC developed in delivering rural health.
Wanamaker says APU has struggled to bring in enough students to cover operating expenses. Generous donors fill the gap, and he says the school is not in a fiscal crisis. Still, ANTHC Chief of Staff Leanne Garrick says ANTHC funding will give the university stronger footing and a chance to grow.
ANTHC has, as part of our partnership, it has contributed funding to help the university, give the university some stability, and then also some of that funding will be used to look at additional expansion of programs. To one end could be the designation of a tribal college, is moving forward in that direction.
Garrick says ANTHC and APU will be working out the specifics of moving forward and come up with a transition plan within the next 90 days. But she says the timeline is not as important as the nature of what they create.
The tribal college distinction is important to us because tribal colleges are it's a model that will infuse our traditions and values into that curriculum. APU being liking that model and wanting to look at that approach is very attractive to us.
One of the first steps to transforming APU is to put a dozen or so tribal health leaders on the APU board. A welcome prospect, says Wanamaker.
What we're most excited about is the energy and enthusiasm that the ANTHC leadership team and new trustees coming on the board of the APU, a statewide representation of new trustees, mind you. That level of energy and enthusiasm and intellect and experience is going to develop great things.
Alaska has one tribal college currently, Ilisagvik College in Utqiagvik, the town formerly known as Barrow. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
a drunk driver who ran his snow machine into the dog teams of two front-running Iditarod mushers during the last year's race, was sentenced in state court in Fairbanks yesterday. Under a plea agreement, 27-year-old Arnold Demoski of New Lotto was sentenced to 6 months in jail and to pay restitution to the mushers, $10,000 to Allie Zirkel of Two Rivers, who had one dog injured, and $26,000 to four-time Iditarod champion Jeff King of Denali Park. One of King's dogs was killed and three others injured in the incident outside New Lotto. King says the restitution does not cover his losses.
I would gladly take the dogs back and my race back in lieu of any restitution. But I think the point I want to elaborate on is I thought Arnold truly impressed me of having remorse yesterday.
King says he hopes the case shines another light on the well-known Alaska issue of alcohol abuse and drunk driving, noting the incident could have been much worse.
As significant and painful loss as there was, I really believe he could have killed me and half the team had he been 1 foot 6 inches closer than he was.
King says two of the three dogs injured in the incident are training in his team.
A third one broke his front right leg and required surgery, and we don't expect him to recover as an Iditarod athlete, but alive and well, and we'll find a spot for him.
King stresses that last March's incident is very unusual for the Iditarod, but says it has made him more vigilant of snow machines while out on the trail. Alaska villages facing rapid erosion have been trying to move for decades, but they've always run up against one major problem, money. Then this year, for the first time, the federal government made tens of millions of dollars available to relocate a small Native village threatened by climate change. The problem? That village is in Louisiana, not Alaska. As Rachel Waldholtz of Alaska's Energy Desk reports, that raised questions about how we decide who gets money to move.
One day this past January, Washington, D.C. reporter Christopher Flavelle got an email. It announced the results of a federal competition awarding nearly $1 billion to communities from New York to California to improve their resilience in the face of disasters and climate change. One project was the total relocation of a small tribe in Louisiana. 60 people, $48 million. Flavelle was intrigued.
I've spent the past year looking at that corner of climate policy.
That corner being what happens when people have to move because of climate change. Flavelle writes for Bloomberg View. He wrote about the Louisiana town, Ile de Jean Charles, and then he had a thought. He called up HUD, the agency that awarded the money, and he said, hey.
I don't think this is the only town in this situation. In fact, I've heard of coastal towns in Alaska. And I wonder, why is it that this place in Louisiana got money, but these other towns in Alaska did not? How did you decide?
And HUD clammed up.
They were surprisingly reluctant to talk about it. In fact, entirely reluctant.
Meanwhile, in Alaska, officials were asking the same questions.
I don't know. We still don't fully understand.
Sally Russell Cox is a planner with the state who helped prepare Alaska's request. That request asked for more than $280 million for four villages, including Nutok in western Alaska. Nutok has lost its landfill, sewage lagoon, and barge landing, and erosion threatens the school, airport, and drinking water. Cox says the team was blown away when Alaska got nothing. After all, President Barack Obama had just visited the state and talked about exactly this issue. And she says the state still isn't sure why it lost out. Apparently, one reason is Alaska didn't put up enough state money to match the federal funds.
And we didn't have it because, I mean, why are we asking for this money if we already have money committed to it?
But Christopher Flavelle says that's not the whole story. For instance, Louisiana didn't commit any money specifically for the Ile de Jean Charles relocation. In the end, he says HUD had a checklist and Alaska just didn't score well. HUD spokesman Lee Jones says the agency always has three, four, five times as many applicants as it can fund.
Their proposals might be able to demonstrate as much need, as much innovation, as much integrity as the winners. It's just at some point the dollars only go so far. And $1 billion, a lot of money, no question about it, but it's not a lot of money when you're trying to address issues of infrastructure resiliency, which is a fairly costly exercise in most communities.
For Cox, the lesson is there needs to be more funding and a better way to decide who gets it.
You don't do it in a competition. That's crazy, because you're rewarding those that have, you know, the best marketing or the best grant writing.
Instead, she says, we need a system to decide which communities are most in need and make sure they get the funding first. Bloomberg's Christopher Flavelle agrees. He says it needs to be clear why one community gets money and another doesn't.
Just as important as finding the right way to move a town is, I think, finding the right way to decide which towns to move. And there has to be some sort of standard that is transparent and credible and defensible.
Because right now, this is a pretty rare issue. There are not a ton of communities talking about relocation due to climate change. But Flavelle says that's not always going to be the case.
This isn't just Alaska, and it's not going to just be little towns along the coast that you've never heard of. This is going to be more and more of the United States. And either we figure out how to deal with it now, when it's a small problem and the costs aren't huge, or we wait and we try to develop some sort of a response, some sort of a policy when we're pressed, when something really bad has happened.
And Alaska has a major stake in getting that choice right. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waltholz in Anchorage.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. If you have an opinionated teenager in your home who thrives on proving a point, check out the Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future Scholarship Competition, organized by UAA's Seawolf Debate Program. More than $10,000 in prizes will be awarded. Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future gives the next generation of Alaskans a voice in the direction of our state. Contest details available at debatingakfuture.com. This message sponsored by Seawolf Debate.
Governor Bill Walker proposed cutting about 45 positions and $3.5 million from the Alaska Department of Fish and Game's 2018 budget last week, significantly smaller than the $11.5 million in cuts over the past 2 years. But Walker's proposal calls for no additional changes to the agency's southeast operations. KSTK's Aaron Bolton reports.
Fish and Game has taken about a 36% cut to its dedicated state funding over the past 2 years. The Commercial Fisheries Division is one of the more susceptible divisions to state budget cuts. State funding is its largest revenue source. Southeast fishery funding under Walker's proposal remains about the same as in the 2017 budget. Commercial Fisheries Director Scott Kelly says the division would be able to sustain its southeast operations under the proposal.
Basically, the projects across the board that we've got in Southeast Alaska for Commercial Fisheries Division are going to be the same as what we had in this fiscal year.
The budget calls for 4 Southeast commercial fishery positions to be eliminated. Kelly noted that will be done through attrition, but says more positions could be cut after the budget is finalized.
As you well know, there were special sessions, and ultimately things were very different from the governor's request. The FY17 request is not what the FY17 management plan and the allocations look like, so things could change is the bottom line.
Kelly says the Commercial Fisheries Division cut 45 positions statewide over the past 2 years. Most of those positions were eliminated last year.
We basically look at each and every position as it becomes vacant.
Commercial Fisheries also stopped collecting data in 2015 for several southeast herring fisheries that haven't opened in recent years. Herring fisheries near Craig and Sitka are still being managed. Several other projects were on the chopping block as well.
And it included a golden king crab observer project, some miscellaneous shellfish dive assessment, quite a bit less aerial surveys, some additional herring cuts that we talked about already, and then some personnel cuts.
Fish and Game's Sport Fishing and Wildlife Conservation divisions don't expect any major changes during the next fiscal year. Both divisions are primarily funded through national taxes on fishing and hunting gear. Hunting and fishing license fee increases will also take effect in January. Hunting licenses about doubled, and sport fishing licenses increased $5, up from $24. Net sales for tags and licenses were at about $29.5 million in 2015. Both divisions took large state funding cuts over the past 2 years, but tax revenue and license fees have been able to supplement those losses. Reporting in Wrangell, I'm Aaron Bolton.
The holidays tend to inspire people to be all the more charitable. And a couple of classes at Peterson Elementary School in Kodiak have made the spirit of giving a monthly tradition. Since September, a group of second grade students have been among those to put a little time aside to make sandwiches for those in need. KMXT's Kayla DeRoche dropped by the classroom recently to watch the kids at work.
Daniel stuffs a ham and cheese sandwich into a Ziploc bag.
I have to squeeze the air out of it so there's enough space for all the pieces of bread in there.
He explains why he and the other kids are making the sandwiches.
We really care about the Red Cross shelter, so the people in need, they have enough food. So now we're making some food for them, so they don't have to make it themselves because they probably don't have any money to buy the things they need. So the Brother Francis shelter takes care of them.
I speak to another student, Holly, while she waits for the loaf of bread to come her way.
What do you think about making the sandwich? How do you feel when you make them?
I feel like I've done something and I'm helping, and I just hope that I feel like I've helped them so they don't have to starve. So that's what I feel.
Teacher Erica Thompson says she first had the idea for the workshop when she saw a Facebook post asking people to make sandwiches to donate to the Brother Francis shelter. She thought it would fit into the community portion of the second grade curriculum.
So we started out the beginning of the workshop talking about community helpers. We went to the fire department across the parking lot here. We researched community helpers. In realizing that you don't have to be in one of those positions to be helping in your community. So I think that's really helped them develop empathy and, you know, discuss homelessness and homelessness in Kodiak.
Thompson says another class also does the workshop, and they deliver the sandwiches to the shelter by the end of the day. I'm Kayla DeRoche.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Aaron Bolton in Wrangell, Margaret DeMiorbis in Nome, Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak, Emily Kwong in Sitka, and Ann Hillman, Jacqueline Estes, and Rachel Waldholtz in Anchorage. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Sean Dugan is our editor and producer, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future that delivers oil today and sustains operations for tomorrow. And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.